Take back the city for yourself tonight. I'll take back the city for me. Take back the city for yourself tonight. Whoa, whoa, whoa.
Welcome to Third Paradigm, a weekly think tank on how to take back control of our cities, farmland and water, of money, production and trade, of media, education and culture, of religion, and even of God. We focus on economics and community sovereignty, and we put the Bible in a socio-theological context by examining how our concepts of God create and excuse the destructive behavior of societies. I'm your host, Teresa Caraggio, broadcasting through Free Radio Santa Cruz and Upstart Radio. Welcome to the ninth episode of Third Paradigm, entitled Friends Don't Let Friends Condone Genocide. We'll start this week's show by looking at what policy and media watchdog groups are saying about Gaza, although a more important point is what the mainstream media isn't saying. I get more news via Peru than in the newspapers. My friend there sent an email with many graphic photos, which I showed to my high school student group. They were stunned. One said they just watched a film on Rwanda, and the students were outraged, wondering where everyone was at the time. She wanted to shout, "This is happening now. Open your eyes. What are you doing?" But what shocked them even more were the maps showing how Israel has consumed Palestine down to the final crumbs. A picture's worth a thousand words, and I guess a scripture of entitlement is worth a million lives. My 10-year-old daughter's friend told her that in Hebrew school, they were taught that giants had lived in Israel before them. They were good giants, but they died off, leaving the land to the Jews. My daughter asked if she believed in giants, and the other girl said, "Not really." "Well then," my daughter answered, "I think what I'm saying about bombs is a little more factical." We'll look more at what's mythical and what's factical in the news on Gaza, but first we'll start with a poem by Naomi Shihab Nye, which she dedicates to her daughter, and I dedicate in my reading to the victims of Gaza. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go, so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows, and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, "It is I you have been looking for," and then goes with you everywhere, like a shadow or a friend. The gorgeous and haunting music in the background was Bara Haas by Julia Kent. The poem is Kindness by Naomi Shihab Nye from her selected poems, Words from Under the Words. Naomi Shihab Nye has a Palestinian father and an American mother. During high school, she lived in Ramallah, Jordan, the Old City in Jerusalem, and San Antonio, Texas. If you go to YouTube, you can find two other excellent poems, Blood and Walking Past the Refugee Camp. They're written on top of slideshows set to music and are a little difficult to read, but the photos are worth the extra effort to discern the words. Over the Christmas break, I called some of my Jewish friends and asked what they knew about the attack on Gaza. Some of the responses were gratifying, others not so much. Some agree readily that those who are Jewish have a responsibility to know the facts and speak up. They are embarrassed not to have been better informed and ask where they can go. One source I recommend is an NGO called ANERA, American Near East Refugee Aid, whose last email reads, "Gaza was already a humanitarian crisis. Now it's a nightmare." They've added a page to their website that compares the UN statistics on Gaza before and after the bombardment, demonstrating that it's gone from worse to unimaginably awful. Another useful site has been FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. It cites headlines and quotes from USA Today, NBC, The Washington Post, The Dallas Morning News, and The New York Times, then shows how they're contradicted by data from the UN, humanitarian groups, their own reports, and official Israeli data. An excellent New York Times op-ed, for instance, is by Rashid Khalidi, called "What You Don't Know About Gaza." I found out that one out of four Palestinians in Israel lives in Gaza, which is 1.5 million people living on 1.5% of the land. At 20,000 people per square mile, it's one of the most densely populated regions of the world. Three-quarters of residents are refugees, who've been herded there by the Israeli army. Over half the refugees still live in 8 refugee camps. Half of the entire population is under 18, which makes 750,000 children. For motives on the attack, Khalidi quotes a former Israeli defense chief. "The Palestinians must be made to understand in the deepest recesses of their consciousness that they are a defeated people." A foremost authority on the topic is Phyllis Bennis from the Institute for Policy Studies. On their website, ips-dc.org, she has talking points on U.S. complicity and the Israeli violations of international law. For instance, the Geneva Convention obligates an occupying power to protect an occupied population and prohibits collective punishment. Palestinians, like any people living under a hostile military occupation, have the right of armed resistance. What that doesn't include is firing on unarmed civilians. Although the low-budget Hamas rockets can't be aimed, no Israeli had been killed by one in over a year until after Israel attacked. On the other hand, Israel receives $3 billion a year in taxpayer-funded military aid from the U.S. Last year, the U.S. signed a $1.3 billion contract with Raytheon for thousands of Israeli Hellfire and Bunker Buster missiles. These have sophisticated targeting devices, so when the UN provides the coordinates for elementary schools where 1,000 refugees are concentrated, their aim is precise. I've ordered Phyllis Bennis's book, Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, which is a primer in question and answer format, so I can understand the history and context better. In addition to Anera, the nonprofit I've chosen for my support is Grassroots International. Rather than having their own people on the ground, they find local community-run organizations. Their Gaza partners include the Palestinian Agricultural Relief Committees. Park's urban gardening projects promote food security for refugee communities. The destruction of more than 80 multifamily apartment buildings in Gaza means that Park will need to rebuild and rehabilitate their rooftop gardens. The Gaza Community Mental Health Program responds to escalating mental health needs resulting from the stress of occupation and violence for Gaza's traumatized population. On December 30th, shelling significantly damaged their building, forcing them to suspend services. Also, the Palestinian Center for Human Rights monitors violations by both Palestinian and Israeli authorities. Its lawyers defend victims of human rights abuses, illegal detention, and torture. And the Palestinian Medical Relief Society is the largest NGO healthcare agency in the occupied territories. Grassroots recently facilitated, in conjunction with Anera, a shipment of $4.5 million in medical supplies. But hospitals and clinics that haven't been destroyed by the violence lack access to even clean water and electricity. I also just joined the Campaign for Labor Rights Working Group on Gaza. Through them, the Palestinian Farmers Union sends this appeal to the international community. An appeal for help from the Palestinian Farmers Union for all living consciences of the world. At the time we try to pull together our wounds, our voices are calling for help and support. We in the Palestinian Farmers Union appeal to all our brothers in the Farmers and Peasants Unions. We also appeal to all international organizations and solidarity with Palestinians' organizations to work to stop the massacre, to stop the siege, and to help and assist the Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip for what they are facing steadfastly of barbarian, fierce attack from the Israeli occupation forces as this aggressive bombardment reached children, women, and the elders, and even trees and stones. We are in the provinces of the West Bank and Gaza Strip, are living these days in a state of panic and shock to the size of the heinous crimes committed by the Israeli occupying authorities against the defenseless Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip. And what we appeal to the brothers and friends in the world is to work on, one, the organization of marches of solidarity with the Palestinian people and demand the world to intervene to stop Israeli aggressions against the Palestinian people, and two, to expedite the provision of financial support and in-kind for the benefit of the Gaza Strip. It is essential that right will win at the end and injustice will vanish. From your brothers and friends in the Palestinian Farmers Union. In solidarity that right will win and injustice will vanish, we'll break for a hopeful song by David Rovics, which I dedicate as a reminder to Palestinians, Israelis, and pro-Israeli Jewish Americans that there will be an after.
Was a time I'll always remember. I could never forget how reality came down around us like some Western movie set. When the dust all settled, the sun shone so bright, and a great calm took over us like it was all gonna be alright. That's how it felt to be alive after the revolution. From Groton to Tacoma, on many a factory floor, the workers talked of solidarity and refused to build weapons of war. No more will we make missiles. We're gonna do something different. And for the first time, their children were proud of their parents. Somewhere in Gaza, a little boy smiled and cried. After the revolution, prison doors swung open. Mothers hugged their sons. The Liberty Bell was ringing when the cops put down their guns. A million innocent people lit up in the springtime air. And Mumia and Leonard and Sarah Jane Olson took a walk in Tompkins Square. And they talked about what they do now. After the colonies, soldiers left their bases, went back to their families. A non-aggression treaty was signed with every sovereign state. All the terrorist groups disbanded with no empire left to hate. And they all started planting olive trees. After the
That was David Rovics with After the Revolution, in which he pictures a future where somewhere in Gaza a little boy will smile and cry. My prediction for 2009 is that Israel will be the straw that breaks the empire's back. The U.S. is already buckling and reeling, although we're determined to go down with a sneer on our face. The president of the U.N. General Assembly, Father Miguel Díaz-Cotto, has said that Israel proves that the Security Council protects privileged interest and not human rights. But now that even privileged interests are losing money on our dollars, I suspect that they'll soon take the high road and blame the atrocities on us. When this event is seen in the long view of history and the wide view of the world, how will pro-Israel Jews answer their grandchildren who ask, "What side were you on, Grandma, when our faith in equality was tested?" Will they reject a scripture that values a piece of property ahead of human lives? Will they ask, "If I have a scripture that says God gives me my own room, Grandma, do I get it?" Israel is like someone who uses a wounded child to gain entry into a house. But as soon as they're in, they pull out a gun and force the family into the closet. After 41 years, they're now pulling them out and killing them one by one, elders, fathers, mothers, and for every third victim, a child. I've asked my Jewish friends how Israel came to be. As they've explained it, the feeling was that Jews couldn't reclaim their original homes and live in mixed societies after what their neighbors had done. So those who profited were, I guess, left with their spoils, while a neutral person's land was taken. Two wrongs making two wrongs. So doesn't the same logic now hold for Palestinians? Why should a permanent UN peacekeeping force be brought in, as liberals suggest? Isn't that like moving a police officer into the house to stand guard between the imprisoned family and the usurper? Israel has proven itself untrustworthy. It seems only fair that those who refuse to fight be the only ones allowed to stay. For the rest of the evicted Israelis, pro-Israel Jewish Americans should be compelled to take them into their own homes. With what they save on housing, they can pay a reparation tax to rebuild, replant, and counsel the traumatized Palestinian children. In this track from David Rovics, he makes a comparison that once seemed shocking and now seems hard to avoid.
"I can't help it. I don't care how far you think the analogy extends itself. When I see you making that bus driver climb up and down, on and off the roof of his bus for your amusement for hours in the hot sun, I think of how we once had to dance and sing for them while they shot our parents. When I see you keep that woman and her husband at the checkpoint while she's in labor and you stand there, listening to her scream, watching as she gives birth on the backseat of a taxi, I think of the walls around our own ghetto and how we had to crawl through the sewers looking for rats to eat while we could hear their children playing on the other side. When I see you crush that house and kill that woman and her baby with your armored bulldozer because they didn't have a permit, I think of the way we were once forced to leave our homes at the point of a gun. And when I hear your general say that in order to deal with the Intifada, you must learn from the tactics of another general, one Mr. Stroop, in Warsaw, I think of how they bombed our buildings, shot us as we fell from the roofs. And I remember how we wished we could kill their babies, too. And I feel sick, sick of your displaced anger, sick of your self-deception, sick of your attempts to deceive the rest of the world, sick of your accusations of anti-Semitism, sick of your occupation, sick of your apartheid state, sick of Zionism. Because standing here in Auschwitz, Birkenau, and Warsaw, I see Jenine, Yaffa, and Rafah. And I think of our ancestors, the Jewish Palestinians, who spoke so eloquently in their Arabic language. But the dead cannot speak. And now I find myself again behind the wall of a ghetto, standing with millions of other Palestinians. And I find myself shouting, Thawra, Thawra, Hatta al-Nasr, tomorrow in Jerusalem, al-Auda, return.
That was David Rovics from his CD, Return. The analogy that David brings up is one I ask my Jewish friends. Was the Holocaust only wrong because it was your people? Would it have been not wrong if you'd been on the other side? On the playground, I asked a Jewish mom what she thought of the events in Gaza. She said that she was avoiding the news because it made her anxious about people she knew there. Oh, I said, Palestinians? Or do the 6 Israelis killed bother you rather than the 600 Palestinians? She said she didn't want to talk about it, but I kept going, saying, you have to make a decision. Do you stand with the Nazis or with the Jews, who happen in this case to be Palestinian? The guy next to her cut in. She said she doesn't want to talk about it. You have to go away now. To put his statement in another context, what he was saying was, the nice German lady doesn't want to hear about the concentration camps. You leave her alone. I know that I'm being rude and obnoxious, but I have to ask. If my children and I were the ones in the ghetto with no food, no clean water, no gas for heat or cooking, no medicine, and nowhere to hide from the bombs, would you be polite? Would you say, gee, I'd like to be your spokesperson here in the open air, but I can't force it on people who don't want to hear. Everyone has a right to their own opinion. It would be wrong of me to judge. I have to ask the pro-Israeli parents of my daughter's friends if my daughter had the courage of a Rachel Corrie to stand in front of the bulldozers, would your daughter run her over? Is it only the roles that we're in that protect me from you? If you're willing to condone something by proxy when no one's forcing you to, what are the chances that you'd refuse to do it if we were born into the direct roles? Would my child's doctor supervise my torture, making sure I live to feel more pain? Would I be alone in the dark, my daughter dying in my arms, knowing that for you, life was going on, dinner plans being made, the news turned off, anxiety medicine taken? These are real questions that every Jewish American is answering in the affirmative if they don't take a stand. Whatever you condone doing to someone else with your silence, you'd do to me and mine if the roles we were born into were different. But here on the playground, you're the civilized innocent victim, and I'm the ranting madwoman. My 16-year-old daughter is much smarter and more temperate than me. When her Jewish friends talk about the war, she innocently asks, "What war?" When they tell her about Hamas rockets, she answers with statistics on the death counts. But she also invites them to bring her their articles because she wants to know more. Then she can exchange information point by point and ask them to show her where her data's wrong. I'm glad that people like her are inheriting the world, because personally, I have a hard time making nice, as the Dixie Chicks would say. Many of the Jews I know feel that ordinary German citizens who didn't do anything directly to the Jews are still responsible. Some have told me that they think they should feel guilt to the third generation, those who hadn't even been born yet. But I'm more reserved in my blame for the ordinary German for the same reason that I'm reserved in my blame for the ordinary Israeli, because I know myself to be a coward. If siding with the Palestinians meant that I'd be in prison, at the mercy of Israeli guards and separated from my children, I don't know if I could do it. If it meant that my children could be killed or imprisoned, I wouldn't want them to be heroes. The greater the potential consequences are, the less I feel that I can judge. But Jewish Americans bear the full brunt of their freedom. With freedom of information, there's nothing stopping them from finding all the sources I just mentioned. My Jewish friends certainly know how to research. With freedom of speech and association, they can talk and question, even in the synagogue. I'm not a friend to them if I allow the rest of their lives to be burdened with a guilt they can no longer do anything about. They're not a friend to Israelis if they allow them to be used as a U.S. mini-me in a proxy resource war. This has cost them their reputation and may lose them their right to stay. The legacy of international sympathy for post-Holocaust Jews is being erased for their children's generation. No matter which way you choose to do it, talk to your Jewish friends. Would you let a friend do something that they'll regret for the rest of their lives? Friends, don't let friends condone genocide. This is Teresa Caraggio with Third Paradigm, produced and edited by Skidmark Bob.
One man, he